This is Audible.
HighBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Close Encounters with Humankind. A paleoanthropologist investigates our evolving species. By Song-hee Lee with Shin-young Yoon. Read by Emily Wu Zeller. Introduction. Let's take a journey together. In 2001, I was about to start a new chapter in my life as an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of California, Riverside. I was planning to ship everything I had to California, including my car, and then to travel elegantly on an airplane. All possible because UC Riverside was covering my moving costs. That plan was soon thwarted. My advisor from graduate school strongly recommended that I drive across the country instead. Of course, I objected. Strenuously. I wanted to get to California as soon as possible, to get settled as soon as possible. But that was only a superficial reason. To be frank, the endeavor terrified me. After a long discussion, I gave in to my advisor's convincing argument that this would be the only chance in my life to experience and feel intimately what America was about. I was reminded of a book that had left a strong impression on me, Travels with Charlie, 1962, by John Steinbeck. I read it after I graduated from college, while preparing to start graduate school in the United States. Steinbeck took his dog Charlie and drove across the country, agonizing over what it meant to be an American and what the nation was made of. He wrote frankly about the problems poisoning America, including racial inequality. From his depiction, it was not surprising at all that the civil rights movement broke out in the 1960s, shaking the whole country to its core. And this book made a deep impression on me as I was starting my life in the United States in 1990. When I left Korea, there was little interest in multiculturalism and diversity among Koreans. To someone like me who had a vague and simple understanding about two races, black and white, the multidimensional aspects of race and the deep-rooted tension between races were quite foreign. So when I took my advisor's suggestion to drive across the country, I decided to make the most of the experience by talking with people everywhere I went, seeing and feeling everything. I packed a voice recorder, along with the rest of my belongings that were not shipped, into my 1994 Dodge Voyager minivan. A reliable car, but one with manual windows, no air conditioning, and not even a tape deck. And set out. I decided on a few guiding principles before I started the cross-country drive. First, I would stay away from freeways and use local roads as much as possible. I didn't have a portable phone back then, so I bought an emergency phone that could only call 911, and a charger that could charge on a car battery. I bought a box of bottled water, a box of crackers, and some simple clothing and toiletries. I felt a little like Captain Janeway from Star Trek Voyager, one of my favorite TV shows. To boldly go where no one has gone before, I thought, as I left my home and hit the road. I started from the confusingly named Indiana, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Pittsburgh, where I had spent a year as a visiting assistant professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Indiana, PA, is best known as the birthplace of the actor Jimmy Stewart. During my time there, it was a mid-sized town that had been declining with Pittsburgh's steel mining industry. As men lost their jobs in the steel mines, women became the breadwinners, often with jobs in the service industry. Many people in Indiana were not too happy with the changes in the economic landscape, both in the town and at home, and the university, rising to be the primary employer as the steel mining industry sank, bore some of that ill will. I spent my entire year there just waiting to leave, hoping to teach at a larger school in a more welcoming atmosphere. With this kind of anticipation for the future, I started my journey across America. First, I stopped in Michigan to say goodbye to my advisor, Milford Wolpoff. He is one of the original proponents of the multi-regional evolutional model for the origins of modern humans. More important, he was my strongest champion and critic, while treating me like family, since I had come so far away from home. I had fallen in love with paleoanthropology, a transdisciplinary field of science and humanities, despite having little science background in high school or college. Without the unwavering support and encouragement from a mentor like Milford Wolpoff, there's no doubt I would have had insurmountable challenges entering the field. I left Michigan and went to Kentucky to see one of my friends from graduate school. She had come to the United States with her family from Saigon at the end of the Vietnam War, and we had become close, partly because we were both Asians. We had lost touch after she left graduate school to move on, via a completely different life trajectory, to a position as a business executive in a big company and a happy mother of two children. Many of us go to graduate school to pursue a life in academia, and many of us leave before completing a degree to pursue another path, as my friend did. In the context of my trip across the country, our reunion made me think about roads not taken. What if she had persisted back then and graduated? What if I had left academia sooner and sought an alternative? On the one hand, it takes a lot of courage to change course after you start the path toward a PhD degree. You have to bear the fear of people thinking of you as a loser and a quitter. But staying on is no light feat either. In the end, no road is easy. Or rather, all roads are beautiful. I started out on my cross-country drive with a big ambition. But as I passed through Kentucky, Illinois, Missouri, driving through an endless flatland, I started to get exhausted. After a brief, cool moment early in the morning, the end of August sun soon would become stiflingly hot. Without any air conditioning, I had to drive with an open window. Perpetually heading west, I was almost always facing the sun, and my left arm was growing darker every day. Sunscreen was useless. The local roads were quiet, with just one or two cars passing me on the other side the whole day. The only entertainment source, the radio, was playing country and western music, station after station. With the hot air coming through the open window, riding in a hot car and listening to slow country music, I felt almost like my brain was melting. There's a reason why people on long trips play exciting, simple music. After driving all day and once the sun started to set, I would stop at the nearest motel. "Do you have vacancy?" I would ask. Then, usually a middle-aged, tall woman at the front reception desk would look at me suspiciously and ask, "You sure you're by yourself?" The way she shot furtive glances past me, I suspected that she thought I was renting a room for one, and then sneaking a bunch of people in. I would grab an easy dinner, come back to my room, watch some TV, wash myself, then go to sleep. Morning would come. I would eat the continental breakfast available at the motel, pay the bill, and get back on the road. I barely spoke a word all day. Perhaps a couple of words during check-in and check-out at motels. Everywhere I went, I was acutely aware of how different I looked. Everyone else was whiter and bigger than me. I shrank every day, little by little. I didn't want to speak to anyone, partly because I was suspicious of strangers, who didn't really invite me to strike up a conversation anyway, and partly because I was just getting very tired of the whole project. Once every 2 or 3 days, I would buy postcards from a gas station or convenience store and send updates to my parents and friends in Korea. After I passed through Kansas, known to be flatter than a pancake, a huge vista appeared in front of me. The Rocky Mountains. The Rockies are a tumultuous landscape. The road continuously curved, climbed, and dropped through peaks and valleys, and I had to be on my guard. I thought of the many pioneers who had tried to pass this way by wagon but had failed, including, of course, the famous Donner Party who got stranded in the Sierra Nevada and had been forced to resort to cannibalism to survive. Finally, I crossed from Nevada into California. The first place I visited in California was Calico, formerly a bustling silver mining town and now nothing more than a washed-up tourist attraction. Calico saw its heyday during the silver rush of the 1880s, with approximately 500 silver mines operating for 12 years. After the silver price crashed in the mid-1890s, Calico was deserted and turned into a ghost town. Actually, Calico occupies a noteworthy place in the history of paleoanthropology. In 1960, Louis Leakey, famous for his spectacular hominin fossil discoveries in Africa, pinpointed Calico as the earliest settlement of the first Native Americans and started on an excavation project. Leakey probably wanted to add an American chapter to his great success story from Africa. Instead, the excavation, which started with widespread media attention and public speculation, ended without any noteworthy discoveries, and Leakey left the site. It's still a matter of debate whether the stone tools discovered in Calico were human-made tools or just a product of natural rock breaks. I started in Pennsylvania, drove 3,500 miles through 10 states in 16 days, and arrived in California a few days before September 11, 2001. Just like that, America was no longer a place where a strange-looking foreigner could slowly drive around the countryside in an old minivan. With my journey over, it was time to start my new life as a professor. I worked hard to prove myself as more than just a diversity hire, though I suspected that may have been the reason I'd been offered the position. Being a professor was challenging. Having grown up in a culture where the king, father, and teacher are considered the Holy Trinity, I found it difficult to get used to an environment where students might consider professors to be their friends and think nothing of expressing differing opinions. Of course, I had experienced a little of this firsthand as a graduate student at the University of Michigan, but it was totally different as a professor. Initially, I held classes the way I was taught in college. I erroneously thought that students would be grateful for the knowledge I imparted to them, and that they would absorb my words like sponges. The students, however, had different ideas. They sat in the classroom, arms crossed, challenging me to earn their respect and attention. It was a completely different atmosphere from my college experience in Korea, where being part of a university, as a student or faculty member, was a mark of pride and demanded respect from others. I realized much too late that I did not have a natural talent for teaching. In despair, I put all my efforts into research. The years passed. I settled in as best I could, and eventually I received tenure. Then, out of the blue one day, I was contacted by Shin Young-yoon, a science journalist in Korea, who proposed I start a column about human evolution in Kwahak Donga, a Korean science magazine for the general public. Intrigued, I accepted, and began writing essays for the general public on various interesting topics in human evolution. As I continued the series, I realized how limited and ineffective it is to communicate in a simply unilateral and authoritarian manner. Yet this is how I had been teaching. I started to tell stories to my students the same way I told stories in my essays for the Korean magazine. Then something miraculous happened. I began to feel passion and enthusiasm about a large course I was teaching regularly, Introduction to Biological Anthropology. Some professors prefer an intimate class, exploring a narrow topic in great depth with a small number of interested students. I used to be one of them. But now I prefer large classes. Among the hundreds of students sitting in large introductory classes, some are taking the course only because they have to fulfill a general education requirement. Before, I used to get discouraged looking at the bored faces of the students filling the back half of a large lecture hall. Now I love the challenge of sparking some curiosity in those same students, of trying different ways to reach them, of motivating them to want to learn more. It keeps the course fresh for me, even though the content stays relatively the same. And inevitably, some of those students who came to take the course because they had to, not because they wanted to, decide to change their majors to anthropology. I found that the same topics that interest young students also interest adults. Of course, this is not surprising. Where we came from, how we lived, or why we look the way we do are some of the fundamental questions we all wonder about at some point in our lives. In newspapers and magazines, New discoveries of human ancestral fossils always get attention. The one lesson that is repeatedly conveyed in all those stories of human evolution is that there is no right answer, and there are no bad questions. Human evolution is an ever-changing field. What is accepted as the right answer at one time can be challenged by new data and a new hypothesis at another time. A trait that is evolutionarily advantageous, that has an adaptive advantage, is ultimately a product of chance. Individuals with a trait that happened to appear, that happened to receive a benefit in their equally random environment, got to leave behind a few more offspring than others who did not have that particular trait. But a trait that is advantageous at one point in time is not advantageous forever. Everything changes. Such is the case through the long evolutionary history of humanity. Sure, there have been major advances in our development, steps that have moved the human race forward. Upright walking is one. A bigger brain is another. And dependence on culture is yet one more. But when we look more closely at the human journey, we see not a straight line, but a curvy, winding river. Humanity did not agonize over the best long-term course for development. We proceeded by making the best decision possible at that moment, within our specific environment. In high school, I was assigned to be in the humanities track instead of the sciences track, because the aptitude test said so. Yet, I ended up studying a field that was both humanities and sciences. I used to think I had no talent for teaching, but now I think I'm a great fit for the profession. Not for a moment, however, do I think it will stay this way in the future. The environment I'm in might change, and so will my body and heart. It was the same way for those 16 days I spent driving across the country. The only thing I could do was decide which road to take while drinking my coffee in the morning, and then drive west for the rest of the day. The 22 stories in this book are inspired by interactions with students in class, and moments that I experienced directly and indirectly. The stories are written in an essay format that is meant to be fun and intriguing. Many of these chapters start with a question I was asked, and some begin with a story that inspired me to delve further into a topic of interest. I have tried to make these topics completely understandable to someone without a background in paleoanthropology. Feel free to start from the beginning and go through all the chapters in sequence, or start anywhere you like and listen in random order. I simply invite you to join me in this fun and exciting journey tracking the origins of humanity. Sanghee Lee. Chapter 1. Are We Cannibals? In the movie The Silence of the Lambs, 1991, starring Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster, Hopkins plays Hannibal, the cannibal. This is one of the few movies I bought a ticket for and then, in the middle of it, left the theater. Going in, I had a vague idea of what the movie was about. I felt a little nauseated by the movie's premise, but I figured I could handle it. I clearly overestimated my gumption, and ran out after one too many gruesome scenes. Thus, it's quite ironic that some years later, I would come to be known as the cannibal expert, albeit briefly. It was spring of 2007. Someone called me at my office. "Hi, I am so-and-so, I can't recall his name, in Hollywood, working for E! News. I have a couple of questions for you, since you are the expert in cannibalism. If someone snorts someone else's ashes, would you call that cannibalism?" "Huh?" "Yesterday Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones said that he snorted his father's ashes. You know who the Rolling Stones are, right? So I wanted an expert opinion on this and googled cannibalism. Your name came up as the first hit. I didn't know that we had a cannibal expert so close. I'm so happy to know you." I was mortified to find out that my name was coming up as a top Google search result for cannibalism. I had taught a class on cannibalism a couple of times, mostly because some students were interested in the topic. Then the class was featured in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Colleagues at the university started to tease me as the cannibal professor. Some sent me newspaper clippings about cannibalism. At the time, there was also an ongoing cannibalism court case in Germany, which I had used as an example in my course. Apparently, someone in Germany had advertised to recruit people to be eaten, then proceeded to kill and cannibalize those who answered the ad, after signing a contract with the victims. Given my general aversion to the idea of cannibalism and only this tenuous connection to the subject, I was understandably agitated to get this phone call from a Hollywood journalist. When I answered the phone, I first wondered whether it was a prank call. But I went ahead and gave him my expert opinion anyway. Cannibalism depends on how it's defined. In some cultures, imbibing the ashes of ancestors is a custom to show respect for the deceased. The Yanomami, for example, are known for this behavior. Many anthropologists would classify this practice as a form of cannibalism. There was no way to know whether Keith Richards was moved to snort his father's ashes by a comparable respect toward his late father, or if his act of snorting was categorically the same as consumption. My interview with the journalist was published in print and on the web. Some of my friends called me, awestruck that my name appeared in the same paragraph as the legendary guitarist. The alleged story about Keith Richards does raise a very interesting question about human nature itself. Are we cannibals? Humans are extreme omnivores. To say there is nothing on Earth that humans do not eat would be only a slight exaggeration. It might not be a stretch to think that there is a tribe somewhere on Earth that serves up fellow humans at their dining table on a regular basis. Movies often depict people who become lost in the jungle, are caught by cannibals, and then dramatically escape right before being boiled or roasted to be eaten. When asked, who are cannibals, most people refer to some idea of primitive peoples living in the jungle. We often think that we civilized people could never be cannibals. But perhaps in a faraway land there are savages, inferior to us, engaging in such shocking dietary customs as cannibalism. I will return to the question of whether there really are cannibals. First, let's talk about another group that some anthropologists suspect were cannibals. This group is quite significant in discussions of cannibalism in modern human populations. Interestingly, the group did not live in a faraway place, nor does it occupy a point far away in time. It is the now deceased lineage of modern humans, Homo sapiens, known as the Neanderthals. Our cannibal relatives? Krapina, Croatia is a cave site that was excavated in the early 20th century. The Krapina cave is famous because dozens of Neanderthals were found buried there. Among the remains were many young women and children, all of whom shared some intriguing characteristics. First, none of the individuals were complete specimens. There were only fragments of each. In particular, there were fewer facial and cranial bones than would be expected. In addition, the bones had peculiar cut marks. What did this mean? Paleoanthropologists interpreted all this as evidence of cannibalism. In the early 20th century, we imagined Neanderthals as brutal savages, violent and uncivilized. Some of you reading this right now may still have this brutish impression of our ancestors. Hairy, stooped, and short, with a violent tendency, somewhat akin to apes living in the African jungle. This negative impression created a bias toward evidence of Neanderthals as cannibals, which became a widespread opinion in the first half of the 20th century. Things began to change, however, in the second half of the 20th century. Some anthropologists started to voice the opinion that there had never been cannibals, Neanderthal or otherwise. Then, an interesting study was published in the 1980s by Mary Russell. Russell, then an anthropologist at Case Western Reserve University, had come up with a new and clever way to test whether Neanderthals had, in fact, been cannibals. Russell knew that many paleoanthropologists assumed that Neanderthals really did kill and eat each other, and were therefore quick to attribute the cut marks on the fossils to the butchering process. But was another explanation possible? Russell hypothesized that there might be an alternative account for the marks. A secondary burial. In a secondary burial, a deceased person, already initially buried, is exhumed after a certain period to have the bones cleaned, and then buried again. In certain parts of Korea, secondary burials were practiced until recently. The cleaning of bones for burial was also an ancient practice observed in some Polynesian and Native American cultures. In these cases of ritual reinterment, the cut marks are not from butchering, but from the detailed cleaning and reburial of bones. To test whether reburial could explain the evidence found at the Krapina Neanderthal site, Russell collected cut mark data from archaeological sites with confirmed butchered remains and from other sites confirmed as secondary burial sites. First, she collected bones with cut marks from big game hunting and butchering from the Upper Paleolithic. Then, she examined the bones at a Native American ossuary with distinct cut marks from secondary burials. She compared the cut marks from these two different sites with those from the Krapina Neanderthal site. As you might guess, the cut marks from the Krapina cave turned out to be quite different from the butchering marks made on animal remains, and more similar to those from the secondary burial sites. In particular, the Krapina cut marks were on the ends of the bones. This pattern was very similar to marks made in the secondary burials of Native Americans, and clearly these marks were not the kind that would result from butchering meat for consumption. It is easy to understand this contrast if we think about the process of secondary burial itself. Usually, at the time of a secondary burial, the body is decomposed substantially, and bones can be cleaned just using a knife. Generally, most cleaning needs to be done at the ends of the long bones, where the joints are, leading to a concentration of cut marks at those points. In contrast, cuts made from butchering leave marks in the middle of bones because the meat, muscle, has to be cut off the bone for consumption, and the midpoint is where the muscle is attached. Russell's study showed that the Neanderthal cut marks most likely aligned with funerary practices, not with butchering. Therefore, the Krapina cave cut marks could not be used as evidence of cannibalism in Neanderthals. Are cannibals all just misunderstood? In the 1980s, when Russell published her research on the Krapina Neanderthals, the idea that there are no cannibals, and probably never were, was slowly spreading among anthropologists. Some argued that the idea of cannibalism was just a misunderstanding or a bias. In fact, the very use of the word cannibal is the result of a misunderstanding by Christopher Columbus. Upon arriving in the West Indies in the 15th century, Columbus mistook where he landed to be India, and he mistook the people he met to be Mongolians, also commonly referred to as the descendants of Khan. Thus, he called them Kanibas. He then sent a report back to Europe saying that the Kanibas ate people. Columbus's story spread quickly through all Europe, and the Kanibas became generalized to cannibals. Europeans were fascinated to learn that cannibals, who until then had existed only in legends and myths, were real. European countries began to compete against each other in securing colonies, and they sent missionaries, explorers, and anthropologists to collect stories about cannibals from faraway places and publish them in articles or books as a form of popular entertainment. Cannibalism became one of the required characteristics of primitive peoples. By the latter half of the 20th century, however, a very different story had emerged. Close scrutiny of the books and reports about cannibals revealed that many of the cannibal stories had no sound basis. Numerous reports turned out to be just rumors. William Ahrens, an anthropologist at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, closely examined all the cannibal records and posited an explanation of the origin of cannibal rumors in his book The Man-Eating Myth, 1979. The source of the cannibal rumors was often recorded testimony from a member of a neighboring or a competing indigenous group, who would tell curious European travelers where one might encounter these cannibals. The testimony often sounded something like this: "We don't do such things, but the people who live on the other side of the forest are ruthless cannibals. I was almost caught and eaten myself, and courageously escaped." Certainly, no European who wrote about cannibals during the early colonial periods was a direct eyewitness to cannibalistic behavior. Ahrens's close examination of these statements led the field to suspect that there was no anthropological basis for claims of historical cannibalism, at least as a part of a regular, normal diet. But can we conclude that there has never been any cannibalism whatsoever in human history? Not necessarily. In fact, certain populations of people, albeit few and far between, are known to have engaged in cannibalistic behavior. Most notorious are the Fari people of Papua New Guinea. The Fari people were unknown to the outside world until Australian officials arrived on the island of Papua New Guinea in the 1940s to conduct a demographic census of its inhabitants. By the 1950s, Australians had built a security station and vehicle roadways into the region. Shortly after, anthropologists and missionaries started to arrive as well. The outsiders immediately took note of cultural customs of the Fari people, including their consumption of the dead. Considered to be cannibals, the Fari were pressured to stop the behavior. The cannibalism of the Fari, however, was highly ritual and tied to their unusual funerary practices, which involved the partial consumption of deceased kin. Among the Fari, when a relative passed away, the body of the deceased was cleaned by matrilineal kin through a unique process that is still unknown in any other human population. It might be a little gory, but let me describe it. First, the hands and feet of the deceased were cut off. Then the arms and legs were defleshed for meat. Then the brain was taken out, and the stomach was cut open and the intestines removed. Following these steps, male kin were given the muscle meat to consume, while women consumed the brain and the intestines. In addition, during this process of cleaning the deceased body, onlooking children were encouraged to partake in this ritual honoring the dead. Although this ritual was widespread in the past, the Fari no longer practice it. But the question remains, why on earth were they doing something considered so abhorrent to so many other people? The answer lies in their particular funerary belief system. By internalizing the dead, the Fari believed their deceased kin would again become part of the living and continue to exist in the village. This may sound outlandish to some, but the belief itself is not so unusual. In fact, many other cultures and religions have a similar version of this practice. For example, the Yanomami of the Amazon mix the cremated ashes of their deceased into a gruel, and all the village people, who are also relatives, consume it. Moreover, the Christian Eucharist, or communion, is based on the belief that one is, metaphorically, devouring the flesh and the blood of the Savior Jesus Christ. These cultural practices all convey the same message. Do this in remembrance of. Therefore, it is not unusual to find that behind the gory cannibalism of the Fari lies a love for kin that we all share. Of course, not all cannibalistic behavior is necessarily affectionate. Some cannibalism originates from conflict. The drinking of blood or eating of a captured enemy's heart during warfare is one such example of malicious cannibalism. Here, the purpose is to eradicate enemies by consuming them. Notably, such acts are only described in historical records. There are no eyewitness accounts of this practice in modern history either. Whether the practice is motivated by love or by hatred, one thing is clear about cannibalism among humans. No human population eats other humans as part of a regular diet. In other words, eating another human is never part of the repertoire of normal behavior. The cases I've discussed are all examples of ritual symbolistic behavior or an occasional cultural custom, but not really cannibalism. Cannibalistic conduct originates not from hunger, but from love or hatred, both thoroughly human emotions, expressed through ritualized behavior. There may be cannibalistic behavior, but there are no cannibals. Let's return to paleoanthropology. Applying the clever method of Mary Russell, archaeologists and paleoanthropologists decided to revisit several other discovered remains, looking for cannibalistic behavior in the past by using the same cross-comparison of cut marks on bones. In 1999, cannibalistic cut marks, cuts toward the middle of bones rather than the end, were found among Neanderthal remains discovered in Moulin-Gercy, France. Seemingly cannibalistic cut marks were also found in Atapuerca, a middle Pleistocene, approximately 780 to 120,000 years ago site in Spain, that predated the advent of Neanderthal occupation. And similar cut marks were found too on human bones uncovered at ancient Native American sites in the United States. The American discovery started a heated debate about the implications of historical cannibalistic behavior. Whether the indigenous ancestors of Native Americans were cannibals was a sensitive topic, involving unresolved emotional and political tensions between contemporary Native Americans and the perceived descendants of Europeans who took indigenous lands by way of conquest and genocide. Native American communities took the charge of ancestral cannibalism quite personally. The debate shifted to the political implications of calling ancestral Native Americans cannibals, rather than focusing on the empirical data. Then, critical evidence was presented in 2001 that seemed to settle the debate. A protein found only in human skin was discovered in fossilized human feces, coprolite, at Anasazi, a Paleo-Indian site in Colorado. The fossilized evidence was considered a smoking gun, indicating that at least some form of cannibalism had taken place in this location at some point in time. We should keep in mind, however, that evidence of cannibalistic behavior does not prove the existence of cannibals. As in the example of the foray and others discussed earlier, it is clear that ritualized cannibalistic behavior has existed throughout human history. Cut marks found at even earlier sites in France and Spain, and in other southern Paleo-Indian sites, might also be evidence of such behavior. Moreover, in modern times there are occasional instances of acceptable cannibalistic behavior under extreme circumstances. A famous example is the case of the Uruguayan rugby team, who became lost after their plane crashed in the Andes in 1972, and survived by eating the dead bodies of their colleagues. This incident became the basis of the movie Survive, 1976. And, of course, members of the Donner Party survived by eating their deceased companions after being trapped in the Sierra Nevada for 4 months. Can we call these people, who had to survive through extraordinary and exceptional circumstances, cannibals? If the Chilean miners trapped in a collapsed mine in 2010 had been forced to resort to such extreme measures to survive, I doubt we would be measuring them with an ethical ruler and calling them cannibals. In the same way, the hominin fossils from the past demand of us a more creative and imaginative interpretation. Could they have eaten their fellow hominins to remember them? Or perhaps to enact revenge during warfare? Or, as the last extreme measure to survive under the extraordinarily harsh circumstances that befell them during the Pleistocene, also known as the Ice Age? We cannot make assumptions about our past beyond the conclusions that the archaeological and paleoanthropological data support. Indeed, there is evidence of ancient cannibalistic behavior, but we cannot call those who engaged in that behavior cannibals for sure. Extra. Huru, the strange disease of the foray. One reason the foray's cannibalism became widely known was the advent of a strange disease in the 1950s. Upon learning about the spread of an unknown disease among the foray, Australia sent an investigative team of doctors, who reported that afflicted women complained of feeling extremely weak and could not stand. Instead, they could only lie down in bed, eating very little. By the end of the progression of the disease, afflicted individuals would experience tremors and convulsions throughout their bodies and ultimately die. Because of the tremors, the disease was called kuru, which meant shaking in the indigenous language. It was also called the laughing disease by some, because patients would fall into fits of non-stop laughter. Kuru has a very long incubation period, normally between 5 and 20 years, but sometimes as long as 40 years. For example, the last reported person to have the disease died in 2005, but he was infected in the 1960s. After the incubation period, a patient usually dies within a year of the symptoms' first appearance. During the first few months of the disease's progression, the muscles gradually loosen and cannot be controlled, leading to slow immobilization. Language function and bowel movements cease, and swallowing food or drink becomes impossible. Finally, death usually arrives through secondary complications of pneumonia, starvation, or infection from bed sores. The horrible disease was a strange mystery to the Australian doctors. There seemed to be no identifiable reason for its occurrence. Enter Daniel Gajicek, a member of the Australian medical team. He came to know of Kuru while conducting research on diseases that seem to affect predominantly indigenous populations living in remote areas. While reviewing the reports about Kuru, Gajicek read that the Fori were known for their cannibalistic practices. He wondered whether there was a relationship between Kuru and cannibalism. In particular, he noted that women and children, who made up the majority of Kuru cases, ate the brains of the dead. Gajicek suspected that the source of the Kuru disease resided in the soft tissue of the brain. In an experiment, he transplanted some brain tissue of a patient who had died of Kuru into a chimpanzee. Within 2 years, the chimpanzee showed the same symptoms of the Kuru disease. Further experimentation by Gajicek revealed that the pathogen for Kuru is indeed located in brain proteins called prions, and one could contract the disease by eating infected meat. Prions are misfolded proteins that can induce other normal proteins to misfold. The scientific community had hypothesized that proteins could possibly be such a unit of inheritance, but the theory was yet to be empirically found. The research that Gajicek conducted on Kuru documented the existence of a prion disease for the first time. Kuru is part of a class of diseases known to plague other mammals and humans by causing complete neurological degeneration. Unlike cancerous cells, which multiply uncontrollably through regular cell division processes, prions transform the cells around them. Several prion-related diseases, such as mad cow disease and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, CJD, have since been discovered, but Gajicek's research is acknowledged as some of the most groundbreaking in medical history. Gajicek was recognized for his discovery of prions with a Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1976. Aside from Gajicek, no one suspected that Kuru would spread through cannibalism, because the Fori usually did not eat those who had died of diseases. But Kuru was an exceptional case. The Fori thought of Kuru as a disease of the mind, not of the body, so they ate those who died from Kuru. Between the late 1950s and the early 1960s, more than 100 people died of Kuru. The patient discussed above who died in 2005 was the last patient. Currently, scientists hypothesize that the Kuru epidemic started with the funerary rituals for one person who must have had Kuru, which was endemic to the population. The disease spreads not only from eating the infected brain, but through open wounds. The women who continued to clean the dead bodies even after being cut during the cleaning process were probably infected this way as well, increasing the contagion rate. Chapter 2. The Birth of Fatherhood. There is no question that the human family is unique. Human families involve adult men. This simple fact sets humans apart from almost every other primate. The mother-infant dyad is a near-universal basic unit in primate social groups. Females give birth and take care of their young until they can be on their own. Although other females will help in taking care of the baby, the majority of the responsibility lies with the mother. In contrast, human mothers rely on others to help with child care by spending time with their children or by providing supplemental resources. And in many cases, that additional contribution comes from fathers. Yet for many other animals, reproductive success for males consists of getting as much access to as many females as possible, with little to no concern for raising offspring. What led to the unique human model of family? Let's explore this question by starting with our primate ancestors. Gorillas and chimpanzees use different mating strategies. Nature does not like to waste energy. And that goes for mating and having offspring, too. At least in theory, A male's reproductive capacity is infinite. His number of sperm is substantial. He can replenish his supply, and he can impregnate other females right after impregnating one female. Thus, it follows that the optimal goal for a male is to transfer as much sperm as possible to as many females as possible. In contrast, a female's reproductive capacity is limited. The number of eggs she can release is small and fixed, and once a female becomes pregnant, no additional pregnancies are possible during her periods of pregnancy, childbirth, and breastfeeding. For females, therefore, the optimal goal is to choose well, selecting sperm of the highest possible quality during their fertile period. One could say that males are for quantity and females are for quality, as far as reproductive endeavors go. Since males and females have a conflict of reproductive interest, they need to employ diametrically opposed strategies. It is rather strange to posit that males and females, who have to coordinate their efforts to reproduce, must also engage in competitive strategies to best pass on their genes. For most apes, the intensity of male-male competition depends on the energy involved in raising offspring, and the number of males available for each female in estrus, the period during which females signal that they will soon be fertile. Generally speaking, the more a female provides for herself and her offspring, the less involved the paternal male will be after mating. If, instead, the female provides less, the male has to contribute that much more energy. Hence, the male will spend less effort making babies, by competing with other males, and more effort raising them. What happens if all females reached estrus at the same time, as they do in gorilla communities? In theory, males would not have to spend as much time and energy on guarding mates or raising offspring. They could just approach all females at once, during the period of time they were in estrus. In this scenario, however, all males would be in competition for access to mates at the same time, and every male would have to outcompete other males for exclusive mating privileges. As a result, a substantial amount of energy would be spent, perhaps even wasted, in male-male competition during female estrus. To prevent such inefficient use of energy, male gorillas, to take one example, often engage in competition and decide on ranks before the estrus period, to ensure that during estrus, only high-ranking males will approach females. In this case, it is quite difficult for a lower-ranking male to openly approach females within the group. Since the ranks are already decided, the high-ranking males can make symbolic displays of aggression without engaging in physical competition. This way, males can conserve their energy for mating. This strategy benefits the higher-ranking males, but it is quite detrimental for lower-ranking males, since it means that these males may never have a chance to reproduce. The real winners of this strategy may be the females, since they do not have to agonize over selecting the highest quality mate. Instead, only high-ranking males will approach females after the intense competition period to sort out the hierarchy among themselves. The females may be singing the song of triumph. In this kind of competition among males, the two traits that help determine outcomes are body size and canine size. For males, the bigger they are, the better they fare in physical and visual competitions. Gorillas are perhaps most famous among primates for such male-male competitions. Male gorillas are much bigger in body size, skull size, and canine size than female gorillas. This difference between males and females, called body size sexual dimorphism, reveals the intensity of male-male competition. In short, the more intense the male-male competition is, the bigger the males are in comparison to the females. Some apes, however, take a different approach. Take a look at chimpanzees, for example. Female chimpanzees do not have synchronized estrus. In other words, different females become fertile at different times, a challenging situation for chimpanzee males. Even for the strongest male, it is extremely difficult to constantly guard a mate at all times against other males. In contrast, gorilla males have to guard a mate only during the relatively short period of estrus. Unsynchronized estrus is challenging for chimpanzee females as well. Because of the mate selective pressures associated with unsynchronized fertility, the strategy of female chimpanzees differs from that of female gorillas. Female chimpanzees copulate with as many males as possible. Needless to say, males also copulate with as many females as possible. In chimpanzee groups, males do not compete intensely with each other for rank, and various males may approach any female in estrus. Consequently, copulations occur throughout the year without a particular peak period. In such a scenario, what does a male do who wants to outcompete others and make sure his genes are transferred to the next generation? The answer lies in his sperm. Chimpanzee males release copious amounts of sperm to compete with sperm from other males. The competitive advantage in this case, then, is to make as much sperm as possible. For this particular strategy to work, bigger testicles are more useful than bigger body size. As you might expect, chimpanzee males and females have minimal body size sexual dimorphism, meaning they do not differ much in body size or head size, although they may differ more in canine size. But chimpanzee males have the largest testicles in proportion to body size among apes. Mating strategies in humans. Once mating occurs and pregnancy ensues, female chimpanzees do not know whose sperm contributed to making the baby. The father is essentially unknown. And female gorillas, despite the mate-guarding practices from males, don't really know who the father of the offspring is either. Just because a male has a high rank does not mean he has an ironclad monopoly on fathering the next generation. Paternity testing among gorillas has shown that the lowest-ranked males surprisingly have a fairly good chance of reproducing, especially over middle-ranked gorilla males. Why? Because middle-ranked males become stressed by the competitive attention they receive from higher-ranked males, while low-ranked males fly under the radar. During the time that high- and middle-ranked males are concentrating on competition, low-ranked males may be able to court females. Neither of the mating strategies adopted by gorillas and chimpanzees give males a clear sense of paternity. Therefore, it makes sense for males to concentrate their efforts on making babies and invest no effort in raising them. Indeed, that's what we see. No male apes raise babies, and chimpanzees thus don't have the experience of being raised by a father. As we all know, however, humans are different. Human males, with smaller bodies than gorillas have and smaller testicles than chimpanzees have, take an approach to reproductive success unlike that of any other ape. They focus on childcare. Let's consider the first bipedal hominins from 4 to 5 million years ago. Females who were pregnant or breastfeeding likely had some difficulty moving about. They most likely limited their range of movement or foraged more for plant-based food sources. Males, on the other hand, would have had free hands and less weight to carry around. They could travel more widely and hunt for animals as well. Males could use acquired food to their advantage as leverage to access females in estrus. But what about pregnant or breastfeeding females not in estrus? Since ovulation suppression makes females infertile during breastfeeding, there would appear to be no benefit for males to get on their good side. Why wouldn't a male give his food to other promising females instead? The obvious argument is that a pregnant female might carry his genes. Provisioning for that female then would have a direct benefit for that male's own reproduction. Of course, there needs to be an assurance that the baby involved is indeed genetically related to the male in question. Humans have tackled this question by taking mate guarding to the extreme, in the form of monogamous relationships. Male versus female. Keep estrus secret. Let's take a look at the monogamous situation from the female's point of view. It is certainly a benefit to the female if the male continues to bring meat and other resources. Females are fertile for only a couple of days each month, however. How does the female make sure the male keeps bringing food for the rest of the month? One explanation proposed that the female strategy was to hide estrus and force the male to provide continuously. Females have come up with a marvelous way, evolutionarily speaking, of hiding their estrus not only from males, but even from themselves. As human females, it was argued, we do not necessarily know the precise time of our estrus, and we have our evolutionary ancestors to thank for this. The result? Humans have sex all the time, regardless of fertility cycles, and men end up returning to the same woman. Some scientists believe that the union of one man and one woman, mediated by the exchange of sex and food, led to a package deal in human evolution of sexual division of labor, the nuclear family, and bipedalism, all of which allowed the males to provide for females and children. This theory of human origins is called the Lovejoy model. Owen Lovejoy, an anthropologist at Kent State University, proposed this model in a 1981 paper with the title The Origin of Man, published in the renowned journal Science. His article caused a passionate social response, which became his claim to fame. Anthropologists have examined the Lovejoy model closely. If the model is correct, early hominins should show signs of bipedalism. And since male-male competition would be weak, early hominins should show smaller differences between males and females in body size. The low level of male-male competition should also have led to smaller canines in males. Looking at the earliest known hominin when Lovejoy introduced his model, Australopithecus afarensis, we see that only half of the predictions were supported by the available data. Australopithecus afarensis had canines smaller than those of gorillas or chimpanzees, but bigger than those of modern humans. Sexual difference in body size was also less than what is observed in gorillas, but more than in modern humans. Australopithecus afarensis was bipedal. All this evidence might suggest that early hominin mating strategies were different from those of either gorillas or modern humans. In 2009, a special issue of Science included several papers on a newly discovered early hominin species, Ardipithecus ramidus, who existed nearly a million years earlier than Australopithecus afarensis. Included in the issue was a paper by Lovejoy's research team, which argued that Ardipithecus ramidus was bipedal and had a small body size difference between males and females. So, does this mean the Lovejoy model is correct? Was Lovejoy wrong? Lovejoy's provisioning model provoked an especially strong critique from feminist anthropologists. The model implied that the idealized nuclear family, a monogamous marriage pair bond between a man and a woman, with the man working and earning money while the woman stays at home raising children, was supposedly written in our DNA from the beginning of human evolution. In other words, women have for millions of years been getting food in exchange for sex with men. Research in the past 30 years lends support to the idea that the Lovejoy model is wrong. First of all, humans are not the only species engaged in recreational sex during and outside estrus. Dolphins and bonobos, Pan Paniscus, the closest relative to humans, engage in continual sexual activity. But they do not have nuclear families. This ideal of a nuclear family is most likely a product of capitalism and the market economy, rather than a biological imperative. Lovejoy's model might have been less about human origins and more about men's fantasy of having infinite sex. Most surprising, humans do not have hidden estrus, contrary to the basic assumption made in the Lovejoy model. Women act differently, knowingly or unknowingly, during ovulation, and men respond accordingly, knowingly or unknowingly. Anthropologists have discovered that during ovulation, women have a higher-pitched voice and lower appetite, experience swelling of the mammary glands, and might, unknowingly, choose to wear clothes that are considered attractive by both men and women. Men, unknowingly, are more strongly attracted to the smell of ovulating women and secrete more testosterone, the male hormone responsible for heightened male sexual activity as a result. If one day a certain woman looks particularly beautiful all of a sudden, you, I'm addressing the heterosexual men here, might be responding to an evolutionary hormonal calling. The dawn of humanity and the birth of fatherhood. In human families, men usually play a prolonged role as fathers, putting care, love, money, and time into raising their children. According to the Lovejoy model, they behave this way because the children are genetically theirs. But something is not right with this genetic calculus argument. Like other male apes, a human male has no direct means of knowing for sure whether he is the genetic father of the children he's raising.